One more grandson story. Well, this one's about Bobby, Bryce's younger brother. And if you're the youngest sibling, you know what I mean by it all rolls downhill. And Bobby's at the bottom of the hill in his family, so he catches a lot of grief from his older brother. But Bobby's learning how to dish it out as best he can. He's not quite as big as Bryce yet, but that day's coming, and Bryce probably doesn't understand that. But they were at the house here recently, and Bobby and I are sitting on the back patio. We're just chatting. And he says, Bryce has stupidism. And I said, well, Bobby, that's an interesting word. I've never heard of stupidism. What is that? And he said, well, Papa, when Bryce turned 2 and he learned to stop talking, you understand what I'm saying? Stupid. He's stupid when he started learning how to talk. So that's what stupidism is, if you ever hear the term stupidism. I guess when you learn to start talking, maybe you're stupid. From Bobby's perspective, that's just a dig on his brother. So that makes him feel better about himself, I guess. You know, I was thinking about coming in from my family, and I've stepped through the narrow gate, and I'm on my road. And all I can see is a white picket fence on both sides, as I said last night. Peace, order, calm, because that's all I've ever known. Because I had just a wonderful childhood. But what I'm bringing in, as I talked about last night, is I'm bringing a lot of pride with me. I'm bringing in this image that I have of myself, which was a pretty high image. I'm bringing in that I can only be loved if I perform well. I'm bringing in fear and worry because it seems to be a natural part of me. As far as I can remember, I've had a tendency towards worry and fear. So I've stepped onto the road, and my pride just can't help itself. It says, Gary, you now have Jesus Christ in your life. You thought you were good. You are exceptional now. You're better. You have elevated yourself now that you have Jesus Christ in your life. You're unbelievable. Dude, you're solid. Well, God had some other ideas about what this road was going to look like. And I would have to say with this new life in me, I'm thinking, where do I go from here? How do I start down this road? What does this look like? And all I really knew was to go to church. That's the only thing I knew, because I didn't. Paul Pressler probably spent about 6 months with me, and it was very valuable. But if any of you guys have ever spent much time around Paul is a teacher, but he comes from a theological perspective. And as best as he was doing, he was trying to help me understand what has just happened to me. But he's using words that just were straight over my head. I just couldn't connect with Paul. But I still appreciated his willingness to spend some time with me. And Paul was very active in his church. And you know, that's where he directed me. So that's where I went, because in a sense, he was kind of my first Paul, you know, for a very brief period of time. And I respected Paul and I appreciated his time that he was willing to invest in me. So I was going to go do what Paul was asking me to do. But God, as he has already saw what that road was going to look like. And when I look back today, that picket fence is a mess. It's just been blown up, picket by picket. And he was going to re-image me into his son, which he's still doing today. And he tells me in Philippians 1:6 that the work he's begun will not be complete until the day of Jesus Christ. So his work will be done my last day on this earth, my last breath. I'll be perfected. My faith will be where he wanted it to be. I'll be the image of his son that he was striving for to get me to. And that's what it'll look like. So I have to understand that my road, my difficult road, is going to continue to be a difficult road. It's just the way it is. So I'm just going to give a brief outline of what this difficult road has looked like, and then I'll go into a few stories with it. The first thing that happened was in my marriage early on, because of being an only child, I'm so enmeshed in my relationship with my parents, I don't break from them. And so I'm trying to manage two relationships. I'm trying to manage a relationship with my wife, and I'm trying to manage this relationship with my parents because I'm still tethered to them. And that caused a lot of problems in my marriage early on, because naturally my wife wanted me for herself. She didn't want to share me, and she's having to share me with my parents. And I began to realize that this was creating problems, and probably several years into it, I finally break. And it was interesting. My dad is who I had to break from. He was the one holding me. And he didn't let me go till I was 30. I mean, he told me when I'm 30, he said, "Well, son, you're old enough now, I'm going to let you go." "Well, that's great, Dad, but I let you go about 5 years ago." Okay. But anyway, it was okay to hear. It didn't really matter to me at that point because I'd already broken from him. And it might have helped the relationship a little bit, but I think my wife never probably really felt like I 100% broke from my dad. And so it continued to kind of sit in the back of her mind in our marriage. So I've got that. Divorce. Adultery. Two rebellious sons. A daughter that struggled with emotional issues from the divorce. A very difficult relationship with her stepfather. Traumatizing relationship with a boy in high school, which I didn't understand the depths of the trauma until later on in her life. I've been fired once. I've been laid off twice. My oldest son is now divorced. And then my current job is probably the hardest job I've ever had in my life, which at 65, I was not expecting to be working this hard. But this is where we are. So God, in forging me, he's dealing with my fear. He's dealing with my image and pride and being a warrior. As I talked about last night, that I want to be perfect, but it's impossible to be perfect. I do not want to make mistakes. I'm still like that today for whatever reason. I just struggle to make mistakes. I live a pretty conservative life, close to the vest. But that's being driven by pride. So God is just, as he's killing my flesh, he's just giving me opportunity after opportunity to trust him and to obey him and to be faithful to him in learning this. And a thing that's always been a little bit of a mystery to me is, why is it in my mind I have zero issues trusting God? In my mind, 100%. I would never doubt God. It's an issue of the heart. That's where God is working. And eventually, maybe my heart will get to where my mind is, but God is working these things out in my heart because that's where I live. I live out of my heart. I don't live out of my mind. That's just where the essence of who I am is in my heart, and God is working there. Jeremiah 29:23, great verse. God says, "Is my word not like fire? And a hammer that breaks rocks into pieces." Well, that's what he's doing. He's using that fire to forge me, and he's using a hammer that is shaping me. And in the forging process, you're in the fire, you get beat on, you get cooled off, and then the process starts all over. And maybe while you're cooling, you have a little season of rest. And then the process starts all over again. The fire, the pounding, and then the cooling off. And in the end, man, it's a beautiful sword. God will have finished his work. Beautiful, shining piece of work. And it's all God. It's for his glory and his pleasure. Just like he took pleasure in bruising his son, he takes pleasure in forging me, in reimaging me into the image of his son. It brings him pleasure because it's bringing him glory as he sees his son becoming more and more evident in my life. As John the Baptist said, I've got to decrease, Lord, you need to increase. And this is what God's doing. He's bringing the Lord Jesus' life more to increase in my life. He's using tribulations. And out of the tribulations, he's producing perseverance. He's producing character. He's producing hope. But it's not my perseverance, and it's not my character, and it's not my hope. It's those things belong to Jesus. And that's what he's working into me. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Can you give thanks, Gary, when I'm bringing you into the fire and I'm pounding on you? Can you be thankful for this? Because what I'm doing is I'm testing your faith. I'm trying to produce in you perseverance. I'm trying to produce in you patience. I'm trying to produce in you to trust me and have faith. I'm perfecting you. And in the end, your faith will lack nothing. You will be complete when I'm done with your work. 1 Peter 5:10 says, but may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Jesus Christ, after you have suffered a while, he's going to do four things. He's going to perfect. He's going to establish. He's going to strengthen. And then he's going to settle you. And then the process is going to start all over again. He's perfecting me, is what he's doing. And the process of being perfected is not pleasant. But he desires a thankful heart. And I will say that God has brought me to a place that I think I can pretty honestly say that I'm thankful for everything today. But it wasn't always like that. But I had to start somewhere. And I just started saying thanks. I didn't mean it. But I had to start somewhere. And then there's things that come up and I'm saying, God, this is a strange thing to be giving thanks about. But it's just learning. God loves a thankful heart. He loves faithfulness. He loves obedience. Because it's the way I can show him that I love him. So I got introduced to this movement in 1986. One of the men in this movement was a board of director to Savings Loan that I worked at. He invites me to a lunch. I thought, dude, this is pretty awesome, man. A board of directors inviting me to lunch. I must be some hot stuff if he's got his eye on me. But anyway, it was a lunch where a man gave his testimony. And then after that, he started a small group, you know. And the only reason I went, we weren't going to church at the time, and my motivation was I just need some fellowship. I got to get around some people, man, because I'm dying on the vine. So that's why I started going. There was a man that took me through Operation Timothy, but it wasn't relational. It was a program to this man, and that's what he modeled for me, was a program. And so the first couple of guys I discipled, that's how I treated them. I didn't know any better. That's all they'd been modeled. It's kind of a program. There's a little bit of relational, but not much. We gotta get through this material, man. You're not a project, but you might feel like a project, but I've got a time frame here. We need to work our way through it. So about a year and a half into being around these men, I get introduced to the man that will become my spiritual father. And I meet him, and I thought, well, he's pretty different from the man that took me through Operation Timothy, meaning he seemed to be genuinely interested in me. He seemed to be pretty authentic. And I thought, I kind of like this. This is different than what I've experienced with the other guy. And so we met a few more times, and then I approached him. I said, would you be my spiritual father? He said, well, I'll get back to you on that. Let me pray about it. And I'm thinking, what do you mean? Can't you just say yes to me and let's go on down the road, you know? But fortunately, the Lord led him to say yes to me. And so we started meeting in 1988, you know, and we've been meeting ever since then and become very close friends. The interesting thing to me, as God put this man in my life and that he would become my spiritual father, is that the path that he and his wife would walk is pretty close to the path that my wife and I have walked. Just amazing. But they're ahead of us. They've already walked through a bunch of this stuff. But God just perfectly placed this man in my life, that knowing what my life was going to look like and what was coming, and that I could have a man who could understand, kind of like Jesus, who understood what it was to be human and to experience everything that we experience, that this man would have experienced these things ahead of me, and he could come alongside me and walk with me through these things. So he walks with me through my divorce, and I didn't tell anybody that I was even separated. I was so humiliated, you know, that my pride just wouldn't let me tell anybody that, you know, I was getting separated. So a couple of months, and I'm over at my spiritual father's house one Sunday, I said, I said, look, man, I appreciate if you don't tell anybody. I'm just not ready to start promoting this. So we'd run an errand. We come back, and his wife's out in the yard, and he goes, hey, Gary's getting divorced. I said, oh, man, come on, man. I asked you not to say anything, you know, but anyway, I think that was God's way of starting to move me through the pride, you know, that I'm working through, and the humiliation that's coming from being, you know, divorced. And, you know, you might think about the heart of a woman like a flower. And once that flower closes, that flower is not going to open back up. That's my experience. And I tried to open that flower back up, but it never reopened. And she just basically said, look, I don't love you anymore. I don't want anything from you. I just don't want to be your wife. And I'm out. And probably to this day, I'm not even sure. I've been told why. It doesn't make sense to me. And so I just have to let it go, because we had a very peaceful relationship. I mean, we got along. I thought we enjoyed each other, but I do realize that kind of at the very end, we're just existing. You know, there wasn't the relationship there. So was I surprised? No, but still the reality of it brings a little bit of shock with it. So we're separated, and man, our physical intimacy was just almost non-existent for years. So I'm hurting. I mean, I'm kind of starving for attention from a woman. And, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, I'm just separated. I'm not divorced. So I can't date. You know, this is what I'm thinking. And then this woman comes to work where we're working. And I don't even know how it started, but there was a connection. She invites me we go have a couple of drinks. She starts telling me, you know, her husband's been unfaithful, blah, blah, blah. Poor, pitiful me, you know. And, you know, I'm kind of being the merciful individual I am. I'm getting drawn into this stuff. And, but I'm still thinking, nah, there's no way this is going to happen. Not in a million years. And never is the kiss of death, really, when you say that word. And I remember one night, before we ever had real physical intimacy, we've got a little wrestling going on. And my spiritual father is coming into my mind. And I'm going, what are you doing, man? I need to be focused here. I don't need his face in my mind while I'm trying to enjoy this woman. I said, so that was an odd moment, awkward, to have those visions coming in your head when you are visioning something else might happen. Well, eventually, we did consummate that relationship. And really, the only way I could be in that relationship was alcohol. And I probably hadn't drank in a number of years. I mean, I really enjoyed drinking. I mean, I did, but I was able to get away from it. But this brought me back into drinking again. And the odd thing about it, in a sense, is that Bruce Witt invites me to do Crown Ministry. I'm thinking, I'm living a sinful life over here. I've pulled away from the movement because I'm living in darkness, and it represents light, and I can't be around it. I don't want to be around it. But I'm over here. I'm in adultery here, and I'm going through Crown Ministry over here. But God, even in the midst of this going on, His word is changing me through Crown Ministry. And it was life-changing in terms of my view of money and how to handle it and getting on a budget and getting a strategy for getting out of debt and getting my financial house ordered with life insurance and a will. And all that came out. And I just thought, God, this is a bit ironic to me that you're still here with me, teaching me your word, and I'm in an adulterous relationship. That relationship lasted about 15 months, and God has said in His word, He would give people up to their lust. And that's what He did with me. He gave me up to this lust, because that was nothing more than what was going on was lust. And I got tired of it. And I got fed up with it. I'd had enough. But kind of the kicker was, is she at the end, she goes, "Oh, by the way, you're not the first. You're just in a line of men." And I thought, man, what a fool you've been. You've been led like a lamb to the slaughter, dude. But here's the beautiful thing about it. I thought that I had so destroyed my relationship with God that the rest of my days on this earth, I would have no fellowship with Him ever again. The only thing I was secure in is that when I died, I would get to spend eternity with Him. But I thought, I've damaged this so badly, there's no way God can take me back. But that's not the God that we serve. And I think that, it broke me. This was my brokenness. This was the punch that put me on the canvas. And Psalm 73, 25 and 26, written by Asaph, he's really struggling with the prosperity of the wicked and the evil. But God brings him to a place that Asaph realizes something. And this is what he says. He says, "Whom have I in heaven but you? And there is none upon earth that I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." And so I said, "God, I only want one thing. I want to be restored. If I don't get anything else." Well, you know that part of the rest of the story. He did. He restored it. And, you know, from God's perspective, His Son died for this. So, His grace and His mercy. And let me just backtrack right quick. The first time that I consummated this adulterous relationship, I thought, man, I got to go tell my spiritual father. I really do not want to tell him this. I don't think it's going to go very well for me if I go tell him. So we're meeting one morning. I said, "Man, I got something I got to tell you." I said, "Look, I've committed adultery." And he said, "Oh, huh, okay." And I'm sitting there going, "Well, you're not going to beat me up over this? I mean, this is what I'm thinking. You're not going to just tear me to pieces over this?" And he said, "You know, I've committed adultery. I know what that's like." And so what I experienced, and I was not expecting, was the grace of God and the mercy of God. And that's what God showed me through my spiritual father, was grace and mercy. And man, it felt good. But unfortunately, I chose to, you know, it says that a fool's, what is it, returns to his volley like a dog returns to his vomit. Yep. Well, that's where I headed. I headed right back to the vomit and lived in it. So, you know, you think about the road that we walk on. And for me, you know, in Operation Timothy, there's the illustration of the road and there's the detour that goes off. And I detoured off the road. I really just pushed God aside, because what was really happening with this is that I'd been a Christian 10 years, and I told God, I said, "You know what? I think I got this. I'm mature enough to handle this relationship. It's not going to get out of control. I got it. And God says, all right, man, let's go. Let's go see what you got, man. Let's go see what kind of faith you have if you can handle this relationship. Well, I failed pretty miserably. So I have failed at breaking away from my parents. I have a failed marriage. I have, you know, entered into adultery, failure. So God's just lining me up with a lot of failure, you know, opportunities to fail, opportunities to re-image me, you know, into the image of Jesus Christ. But I was learning that even in all of these things, and God tells us in Romans 8, 35 through 39, that there is absolutely nothing in this world or in the universe that's going to separate my love from you. There is nothing you can do that is going to separate us, you know. And it was hard for me to accept that he could love me in the midst of that, but he did, and he was just waiting for me. When I came back, he's just waiting there for me to come back to the road. Two rebellious sons. My oldest didn't live in my home, but his rebellion was, I mean, it was drugs. It was, I'm just going to do whatever I want to do. It was pretty stealthy. He was pretty sneaky with it, but it meant arrests. It meant bailing out of jail. And he told me later on, he said, Dad, dude, I didn't care if I got arrested because I knew you and Mom were going to bail me out. So what difference does it make? He said, you probably should have just let me sit in jail, you know? Well, after two times of paying for an attorney, I said, dude, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not paying for another attorney for this. But there's a little bit of pride sitting there because it sounded pretty good to me that I could, oh, yeah, I'm not doing this again. Well, it came around one more time, and it wasn't even drug-related, and he was being charged with a felony assault. And he's not a fighter. I mean, he had one fight in his life, and this is what he's got coming, is a felony assault. And his mother calls and said, hey, I'm going to hire an attorney and post bail, or you in? And man, I was thinking, I've already said I'm not going to do this. And so I call my spiritual father. He goes, you can't do this. Your no has to be no. And so it was really, God was just saying, Gary, your no has to be no. So I called her back, said, I'm not doing this. You know, you're on your own. And she goes, well, he's going to sit in jail for 3 months. I said, well, I don't like the thought of him sitting in jail for 3 months, but I'm not doing this. I'm not paying. She goes, all right, I'll do it. I said, okay, go ahead. Well, my son didn't talk to me for 3 months. The week before his trial, he calls me. He says, Dad, I'd like you to be at my trial. And then from then on, you know, our relationship got back to where it was. But, you know, that was difficult. But he did get convicted of a simple assault. The felony got dropped, simple assault. But they sentenced him to, I don't know, I guess 2 years in jail, and then 1 year, but he was going to have to serve 3 months in Harris County. And from what I understand, Harris County is not a good place to be hanging out. And plus, he's a small white guy going into Harris County jail. And so God was absolutely incredible. He protected him. During that time, it was life-changing for him when he came out. He realized he couldn't live in Houston anymore. He had to get out because his problems were here in Houston, and he moved to Austin. Terry and I have two boys, and one of those boys has a rebellious spirit, but he's in your face. And I remember the first time he's in my face and we're arguing. Because I grew up in a peaceful home. I don't know how to argue. And I'm sitting there thinking, what are we doing here? And I look around and Terry's gone. And I'm thinking, I've lost my support. I don't know how to argue. I don't know what I'm doing. The conversation's over. I go to Terry. I say, where in the world did you go? What's going on? She goes, hey. She goes, because Terry grew up in an alcoholic family. And that's what she heard. It was chaos. It was loud. It was arguing. So she goes, man, I felt like I was right back home. I couldn't stay in there. I left. So I just went and started praying. I said, well, I think this is good strategy. When this stuff comes up, you just leave the room and go pray. And I'll go head to head with him. You know, there were a couple of times things got physical. Again, this is so surreal to me because I'm not physical by nature. To have to pin my son against the wall and to say, you know, this is stopping. You can't do this. But part of it was him probably challenging my authority. And I just said, this is not going to happen. Man, this is my home. And if you don't like my home, there's the door. You can leave. Well, why would you say that? Because you don't like my rules. And we don't have that many. But you don't seem to want to follow the few rules you have. So there's the door. But he chose to stay. So, you know, we had chaos until he went off to college. And man, the day he went to college and we get back home, we're left with the one son that's really a rule follower. Oh, man, the peace and the quiet. It was just beautiful. Or as Bryce would say, beautiful. And going through that, with this son, I really, because my oldest son, the other, I think, thing with him is that at the end of his Christmas break, his freshman year, his mother said, I can't handle him anymore. And I said, okay, I'll take him into the house, to my home. And here again, this pride and this arrogance pops up saying, he just needs a father, man. That's what he needs. I'm going to be that father. I'm going to be that dad that he doesn't have. Like, I'm going to make a difference in his life. And I'm walking out of my ex-wife's house, and Casey says, Dad, you know if he doesn't want to change, nothing's going to change. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, yeah, he's changing because he's going to be in my home. You know. 2 weeks before school's out, Terry, with the help of God, finds a bag in his room. The bag is full of drugs. He's got his little address book, the names. He's got all kinds of stuff in there. He's selling drugs out of my house. And, you know, one of the things he had was he had taken sweet tarts and laced them with acid and then wrapped them in foil, aluminum foil. Well, the first thing that comes to Terry's mind, that Kyle is three at the time, he's going to wander in that room. Oh, that looks like candy. She was terrified that one of the boys might get a hold of a, you know, acid-laced sweet tart. So I kicked him out of the house that day. His mother came to pick him up. That was one of my toughest days that I had as a father. But again, you know, I had a spiritual father who had been through this stuff, and he could relate to it and just encourage me and love me through it and pray for me. But to watch Terry go through this, God gave me a glimpse of the heart of a mother. These ladies are wired a lot different than we are. I think because they carry these children, they're connected in a way that we're not connected. We will never be connected. I do not understand the heart of a mother, but I got a glimpse of it because she was so heartbroken for that year and a half. And Terry's not a big crier, but she wept a lot over her son and the sadness of it. But I was grateful. We were both grateful that we had a really good marriage and that it could withstand this. Because if the marriage had been bad on top of that, that would have been really tough. But it was just a very difficult time. But, you know, God is so incredible. And I remember when we're going through this time that just in my daily reading, and even as I prepared for this, and I'm going through my daily reading, God has just given me scriptures. I mean, what are the odds that when I prepare for this, that God, in my daily reading, he's giving me scriptures that are going to support the story that wants to be told? Amazing to me. It's not coincidence. And when we were going through this, I'm in my daily reading in Romans 15, verse 13. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, that you may abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. And I shared that verse with Terry. And I said, man, this is so spot on. This is what we need in this moment. This scripture was perfect for us. But Satan is just absolutely ruthless. He's unmerciful. And we just felt like our heart just was getting shredded by the evil one and his unmercifulness and his ruthlessness towards us. And sometimes you kind of wonder, God, where are you in the midst of all of this? This is really hard, what we're going through. But then he shows up. I'm there. I'm with you. Just hang in there with me. The other thing that we struggled with, Christian parents, and here comes the evil one. Man, y'all are pitiful. You say you're a Christian, and you have a son that's got the wheels coming off. I mean, what kind of Christian parents are you? You're pitiful. And you begin to believe it. And you begin to say, man, he might be right. I mean, I'm not sure we're that good of parents. We can't control this son. But it's just a flat-out lie. It wasn't the truth, but you tend to start taking it in and thinking it might be truth. My daughter, Casey, as I said, she really suffered trauma at the age of 6 when we first separated. It just devastated her little heart. And, it was just emotional trauma for her. And then she's dealing with anxiety as she moves into high school. She's got a relationship with this boy. He's a little bit older than her. And it ended up being abusive, which I didn't know until later years. It was physically and emotionally abusive to her. It's my job to protect her, but I'm not there. You know, this is one of the things that the divorce did. It took me out of the house. And so I can't be there. And her stepfather, she had a bad relationship with him in a number of ways. And that just added to her stress and to her trauma to have a stepfather who she just really doesn't like. And is, it's just things that were just shouldn't be going on were going on. But and then her mother and I, we remarry. And then we both have children. And Casey says to me one day, she goes, Daddy, she goes, Tyler and I don't have a family. But that's just, suffering through the curse of divorce. But they didn't have a family. So anyway, Casey has also suffered from an ailment called fibromyalgia. It's a soft tissue ailment where her body will just start aching. She's had that since she's 15. She's dealt with anxiety since she was 13. She's got, fear of abandonment. And that was the main reason she stayed in that relationship with that young boy in high school. She's got something called cyclical vomiting, which happens once a month with her menstrual cycle. And I'd only heard about it, and then one time I got to experience it, and it's, man, just watching somebody throw up over and over and over, it can last for a day, it can last for 3 or 4 days. So these are some of the things that she deals with. But I have to tell you that, she is, if you were to sit with her and talk with her about it, it's amazing, her attitude. She is grateful for it. And she realizes that God may never change her circumstances, but she's okay with that. She's just grateful to have a relationship with Jesus. And so I just think it's amazing. I had an opportunity to sit down with her probably a couple of years ago. And I just said, look, I just want to talk to you about your life. And I want to give you the opportunity to just tell me what you experienced and what it was like for you. And if there's any anger, anything you want to say to me, anything you want to call me, well, I would like to hear it. And so she spoke for about an hour and a half. Casey's very verbal. But, and then in the end, I had an opportunity to, just tell her that, unfortunately, part of what happens in the divorce is, I was removed from the home. And I wasn't there to protect her. And so, she suffered some things that maybe if we hadn't been divorced, that they wouldn't have happened. But, it's just the curse of divorce is terrible. Tyler has gone through his divorce. That was painful to watch. Now we got two granddaughters that are having to live with the curse of divorce, and it's hard to watch, their suffering. Very interesting how eerily similar the two, that my and Sherry's divorce was, and he and Christina's divorce, just amazing. Interestingly enough, though, Tyler never thought he was damaged from the divorce, ever. And I just kept telling him, there's no way, man, you don't come out of that. Even if your mother and I had stayed married, you would be damaged. So you probably got more damage than you think. But the beautiful thing coming out of the divorce is that something triggered in him, and he finally acknowledged that he was damaged from the divorce. And he could begin to talk to his sister about it, which she had really desired for many years, but Tyler just never thought he was hurt. So God really used that in an amazing way. But, and I'm just looking at all of this and just saying, man, God, it just feels like so much failure that I'm just failing over and over. But God is just using all of this for good. In my job today, I'm working harder than I ever had. Over 40 years, I've had four jobs, but I only did all of them once. That's all I was ever doing. Now I'm doing three of the four. And my Berkman is pretty clear that I am not a fit for this at all. And that's why I'm suffering so much stress. And then I have other responsibilities that have come on with it as well. And I'm being paid as well as I've ever been paid. And I really like that. And but it's a care of the world. And I'm struggling with the care of the world because I really don't want to walk away from the pay. And so I'm wrestling with this. God, if I walk away, what's this going to look like? And so I think some changes are coming from what I'm hearing. But so I'm willing to hang a little bit longer. But I have to say that I'm experiencing God in a way I've never, well, not never, just in a different way experiencing Him. Because the stress at times gets so intense, I just say, God, I cannot do this. Four scriptures that when this hits, that I'm leaning into pretty heavily. Psalm 69:18, which says, the Lord God, our Savior, who carries our burdens daily. He's carrying them. Second Corinthians 12:9. Jesus saying, my grace is sufficient. My strength is made perfect. And Paul says, all the more will I boast of my weaknesses and my infirmities so that the power of Christ may come to rest upon me. And I'm talking to Jesus. I said, what does it mean that your grace is sufficient? What is that? And he said, well, Gary, it's my unmerited favor towards you. You don't deserve this, but because I love you, I gave my life for you. I'm extending grace to you. My unmerited favor is enough in this. that I love you in this way. So I said, okay. I said, I don't know what perfect strength looks like, Lord, but you're telling me that this is what you're going to do. So I'm having to learn to trust that word. 1 Peter 5:7 says, cast your cares on me because I care for you. God doesn't say what he's going to do with it. He just says, give it to me. Let me have the freedom to do what I'm going to do with it. In Ephesians, it's Philippians 4:6-7. Don't be anxious. Gary, don't be anxious. Pray with thanksgiving. Let your request be known to me. Tell me what's on your heart. And the peace that transcends all understanding, and I will guard your heart and mind in Christ Jesus. So I just start praying these things. When this stress hits me, I start praying these scriptures. And I got to tell you, I'm going to say, each time this has come on me, 100% of the time, I eventually end up with peace and joy in my heart. Unbelievable. A week ago Friday, or one day this week, the stress might have been at the most I've ever felt. And Terry comes in, and she goes, well, let me pray for you. So she's praying, and she asks God, she goes, would you multiply his time? And I'm in such a bad state of mind, I just go, I ain't going to do that. I'm not going to multiply my time. What are you praying for that for? He did. What I got accomplished that day was just, from my perspective, it was miraculous what happened. And so my point in all of this is that God is giving me an opportunity to trust his word, to obey it, to believe it, and then let him show me that he's a faithful God and that he loves me. So I wanted to come back to the two stories I told you about last night, the sexual assault and my dad telling me he didn't love me anymore. So at the age of 5, say at the age of 30, 25 years go by, for whatever reason, the sexual molesting comes to my mind. And I'm thinking, man, I hadn't told anybody about this. But the first thing that comes to my mind is the man that molested me. And I just had compassion for him, and I could forgive him. It was easy. It was pretty amazing. I tell my I don't think I told her at the time because we were, maybe I told, I don't remember. But I did tell my spiritual father as well, but I'd never shared this with anybody. Not that I was ashamed, it just didn't come to mind. I just never thought about it. But what was interesting, what I found at the age of 30 until 60, every time I told this story, I would start crying. And I didn't understand what is going on. And then I'm having lunch with a guy one day, and he talked about that he had kind of experienced the same thing and that he had to work through some issues with his father. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me. But, and this is the thing. At the age of 30, after I talked to my spiritual father, I bring it back up to my dad. And my dad says, man, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, you got to be kidding me. You don't remember that? He said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So that was the pain and the hurt. That's what was causing the tears all this time, but I didn't understand it. And so I realized that day after having lunch with that man that I'd never forgiven my father for that. And at this time, my dad's dead. So I go for a walk that day and just have a conversation with him and just tell him that if he would just forgive me, because I've carried all this anger towards him. So it really, you would think I'm over it. Maybe I'm not. I guess really it's just... What you're seeing right now is really just the, just kind of overwhelmed by God, really, and who he is and how he works through these things. So that was pretty amazing. I don't know why God took another 30 years to bring me there, but he did. And then a year after I come to Christ, my dad comes to Christ. And, you know, a pretty major transformation with dad. But, you know, he finally was able to start telling me that he loved me. He would hug me, give me a kiss, you know. So it's amazing the work that God can do. Just got to give him time to do it and the opportunity to work through these things. One of the things that came out of my adultery was celibacy. I told God I wouldn't do this to him again. I wouldn't have sex until I got married again. And I didn't. It was not an easy path to go, but I just felt like I'd hurt God so bad I wouldn't do that again to him, to be unfaithful like that. And the first girl I dated, I didn't even touch her, and she was very confused, you know, because women want to know that they're pretty and they're alluring, and I thought she was all those things, but I wasn't about to touch her because I just couldn't trust myself with it. And that relationship's in, and then I get introduced to Terry, and I just said, look, here's the deal. And I told her about the adulterous relationship, and I said, look, we're not having sex. As a matter of fact, these are our boundaries. We do not touch each other in our private areas. We do not sleep in the same bed together. Our clothes are always going to stay on. And so if you can live with these boundaries, then I think we have a shot here at this, because I'm just telling you, I'm not going to do this again with God. And so somebody said, you know, after you get engaged, man, it's going to be tougher. And I'm thinking, no, it won't be. But it was very tough. But we tortured ourselves because we get on the couch, you know, and kiss and roll around. And, you know, it was just brutal. But we got to our wedding night, and we hadn't had sex. And I got to tell you, that is one of the most amazing nights of my life. We gave God an opportunity to give us a gift. Because my first marriage, I stole that gift from him. But I can tell you one thing, those two wedding nights were 180 degree different, you know. So, so you know, it's learning to trust God. It's been interesting to watch him work in our lives and answer prayers. One little quick story on something little. We take our family on a vacation every year, and we used to go to a place called Utopia, which is around Garner State Park. And my daughter-in-law was in jewelry, and she made Kyle a necklace and a little piece that went on it that he really liked. And so we get back from Garner, and we had been parked in an area where it's river rock, and Kyle can't find his necklace, and he's just freaking out, you know. So Terry and I said, well, we'll go back over to Garner and see if we can find it. And Tyler's walking by, and he goes, man, I give you a 1% chance of finding it. So I step out, and I said, well, I'm going to give God 100% because he can see it. So we go back. Terry stays there looking around. We're parked. I go across the river. I come back. I don't have it. And I walk up. She's got the necklace. And some people that we'd been, you know, next to that day helped her, and they found it. So what does that do for the family? It's a small, temporary thing, but it meant the world to Kyle. But what it does is it shows, I think, my family that God loves us so much that he's willing to do these little temporary things that mean something to us, because my relationship with him and theirs is eternal. And that's what he's focused on, the relationship and the eternal aspect of it. Not this necklace, but it meant something to Kyle, and he was willing to do that for Kyle. And we've seen that over and over and over. Now, the bigger issues for us is dealing with some of the bigger issues of life with our grown children, and learning to trust God with some of those. And I'm not going to tell you we're 100% on that, because we are not. Because we have, I think, inserted ourselves and intervened when we shouldn't have. And I would like to tell you that it was just a pillar of faith, but it wasn't. It was mixed with fear. It was mixed with emotion. And we let that rule the decision. And so, you know, it's been some financial things, and that money's gone to a black hole. But I feel like I don't want to be like I'm a pillar of faith at this point, but I think Terry and I have now learned, we are learning, we got to give God an opportunity to work this stuff out and quit letting fear and emotions run these decisions. Trust me with this stuff. I promise you I can handle it if you give me an opportunity, but you keep inserting yourself in this stuff. So I feel like we, at least for the time being, we're there, but I guess we'll see when something else. I mean, we got something new going on right now, and we got two new things going on, and so I think we're at the place to let God work this out. But I guess we'll see. I don't want to say that I'm there, but I feel like we're moving along. God is with all of this stuff. Is just, you know, we've heard about learning how to suffer well and learning how to embrace suffering, and that's what Terry and I are doing, and God is doing, is He's forging us, is teaching us how to suffer, learning how to trust Him, how to have faith in Him, and give Him an opportunity and give Him time to speak, to work these things out. You know, it makes me think about 1 Corinthians chapter 7 in the battle. I mean, Paul, man, are you kidding me? You're battling this stuff. You're battling the flesh. You're telling me the things you don't want to do, the things you hate that you're doing. And then he says, who will rescue me from the wretched man that I am? And he says, thank God that Jesus Christ will rescue me. So, you know, that's, as you look at this stuff and wrestling with all of this that we're wrestling with, that God, Jesus is just going to rescue over and over and over. I mean, He is right there in the middle of it. We just have to give Him opportunity and time to work. So, praying and waiting on God's, it can be a hard thing because you don't know what's coming. You don't know how He's going to work it out. You don't know the timing that it's going to work out. But He just give me an opportunity to do this. Let me show you that I can handle this, that I've got it. So just trust me with it. So we're still in the process of learning how to trust God and how to have faith in Him and how to be obedient to Him. But He's so gracious and merciful towards us. You know, and I probably still struggle a little bit with performance-based. I wish that I wasn't, but I occasionally still do. I just sometimes wonder, God, I'm not performing very well for you right now. But God doesn't care about performance, you know. As Dave was talking about earlier, I mean, all this performance that could be all sin-related and, you know, sinful, God is not even looking at that anymore. He doesn't really care about that anymore. He cares about me, my relationship to Him, my relationship with His Son, and that Jesus has taken care of all of this. Gary, quit worrying about it. It doesn't matter anymore. You have me. You have my Son. Don't worry about all this other stuff. So, you know, it's just when you're naturally born worrier, it's just going to be something that you're going to struggle with. At least it has been for me. But I feel like I'm learning to trust God in it and to have a thankful heart and just to know that God loves me deeply, as does Jesus. You know, and as I look at life at a chessboard, I can see one little square maybe and one little piece, and God sees the entire board and even beyond the board, and that He's got a lot of pieces a lot of times He's having to work with and to move around in order to accomplish what He wants to accomplish. But I don't want to wait on Him. I want to move the piece myself. Well, Gary, you can go ahead and move it, but you're going to intervene and insert yourself in something you don't need to be doing. So anyway, gentlemen, that's kind of all I have to say about that. But I would like to end with a song, if you guys would listen through it with me. It's a song called There Will Be a Day by Jeremy Camp. It's a song about suffering and how hard this life is, but there will be a day. So, let me get that queued up here.
Battery high. Connector.